Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Stephen Cohen, professor of Russian studies at New York University, who examines U.S. involvement in Ukraine's election crisis and the concern that tensions with Moscow there could trigger a new Cold War. Former U.S. Army First Lieutenant Paul Rykoff, who talks about his service in Iraq and what led him to found the veterans group Operation Truth. And Kathy Kelly, a founding member of the group Voices in the Wilderness, who discusses the connection she sees between the torture being practiced at U.S.-run military prisons in Iraq and Afghanistan and the training American soldiers have long received at the U.S. Army's School of the Americas. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In Japan, the World Day Against the Death Penalty gathered little interest, where 63 people are sitting on death row. In comparison to the United States or China, Japan's number of executions is small but popular with the public. For example, there were few objections when Mamoru Takuma was executed for stabbing 8 school children to death in 2001. Yet, a growing number of lawyers and legislators are starting to question the death penalty. According to the London-based Guardian newspaper, the Japanese Federation of Bar Associations has passed a resolution urging the government to suspend all executions and to end the secrecy that surrounds the timing of executions. The legal association worries that poor legal representation can lead to false convictions, something that has happened to several death row inmates in the 1980s. A group of 100 Japanese parliamentarians are pushing for the abolition of the death penalty to be replaced by life imprisonment without parole. The Council of Europe has threatened to pull Japan's observer status until the Asian nation imposes a moratorium on the death penalty, which Japan had in place from 1989 to 1993. The United States and Japan are the only industrialized nations that carry out executions. Last June, there was glee on the streets of Kingston, Jamaica, when word spread that gay activist Brian Williamson was stabbed to death. It was a clear message to Jamaican gay citizens to stay in the closet or live in fear as openly gay men or women. A recent report by the Human Rights Watch titled Hated to Death documents the level of anti-gay violence in Jamaica and its relationship to the island's high HIV infection rate. The report concludes that gays are often harassed and sometimes attacked by the Jamaican police. Jamaica has laws that punish gay sex for up to 10 years in jail. According to The Economist magazine, Jamaica has the highest HIV infection rate outside of sub-Saharan Africa. Meanwhile, neighboring Caribbean nations like Barbados and Bermuda have lowered the incidence of HIV/AIDS by distributing anti-AIDS drugs. One of the culprits of AIDS fear in Jamaica is explicit anti-gay lyrics in some dancehall reggae music, which encourages violence against gays. Still, Jamaican officials were defiant in responding to the Human Rights Watch report. Tourism Minister Alon Dombet Asamba demanded, "Bring me the proof." All he needed to do was to look in the report, which was based on 130 interviews with victims of gay violence, health workers, and local officials. Acting on the request of the chemical industry, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency removed a chemical compound from the list of air toxins it regulates, and four other substances were classified as less dangerous than previously identified. According to the Environment News Service, the solvent ethylene glycol monobutyl ether, or EGBE, which is used as a hydraulic fluid and coating on metal cans, will be dropped from the EPA list of hazardous air pollutants, but instead will be regulated as a volatile organic compound and be listed on the toxic release inventory. In 1997, the American Chemical Council filed a petition to delist EGBE. After two rounds of analysis, EPA found that outdoor use of the chemical would not harm people or the environment. But testing by coastwide laboratories found that indoor use of the chemical in wax or a finished stripper could cause health problems. EGBE has been shown to be toxic to the liver, kidneys, lungs, and red blood cells. In addition, EPA declassified T-butyl acetate, TBAC, as a volatile organic compound, a move blasted by the Natural Resources Defense Council as violating the basic rules of chemistry. In its rebuttal, the NRDC says there is no reasonable argument for the change, especially as public exposure of TBAC will no longer be regulated by the EPA. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
For weeks, the U.S. media has featured extensive coverage of the massive protests in Kiev, dubbed the Orange Revolution, which resulted in Ukraine's Supreme Court invalidating the November 21st presidential election after allegations of widespread fraud. The West's favored candidate, Viktor Yushchenko, will now face Viktor Yanukovych, backed by Moscow, in a new election scheduled for December 26th. Yushchenko claims that he was poisoned by dioxin in a failed pre-election assassination attempt that left his face disfigured. But while the Bush administration charged that Russian President Vladimir Putin had improperly interfered in the tainted November election that had initially seen Yanukovych declared the winner, the U.S. was itself deeply involved in Ukraine's political process. British and U.S. press reports indicate that the U.S. spent more than $65 million in support of Ukrainian opposition groups and the underwriting of an exit poll used to discredit the election results. Although the U.S. says it did not directly fund candidates, but rather supported groups working for democracy, some members of the Ukrainian parliament are demanding an investigation. The U.S. State Department has been selectively engaged in similar efforts in other nations once part of or allied with the former Soviet Union, such as Georgia, Belarus, and Serbia. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Stephen F. Cohen, professor of Russian Studies and History at New York University, who examines U.S. involvement in Ukraine's election and the concern that tensions with Moscow there could trigger a new Cold War.
The stakes here are enormous, both for American-Russian relations, for the situation in Ukraine, which is a very large country, nearly 50 million people. Though it's scarcely reported in this country, both Moscow and Washington, both Russia and the United States, have been deeply, deeply involved in the Ukrainian election, and not just on the eve of the election, but going back probably a year or so. Russia's involvement is well documented. It's the main theme of American media coverage, or at least print coverage, that the Russians sent electoral experts, so-called, to Ukraine to advise Russia's candidate, Mr. Yanukovych. Russia broadcast into Ukraine through state-controlled radio and television. They were unabashedly pro-Yanukovych. The president of Russia, Mr. Putin, several times endorsed Mr. Yanukovych, traveled to Ukraine on one or two occasions, invited Mr. Yanukovych to his birthday party, which in Russia is a great honor to be invited to anyone's birthday party. All this is well known. What's less documented, and one can think about this as one wants, one can think it's a good thing or a bad thing, but the United States has poured tons of money into Ukraine in support of what we call civil society or democracy. That is where the Russians have been upfront about their support of Mr. Yanukovych. We have said we aren't really supporting a candidate. We're nonpartisan. We're not really in Mr. Yushchenko's corner, the pro-Western candidate. We're just in the corner of democracy. This, of course, is a brilliant, useful half-truth. Because civil society and democracy are code words in this case for the pro-Western candidate, Mr. Yushchenko. Nobody knows exactly how much American or Western money has poured into Ukraine. The State Department admits having spent about $14 to $16 million on various programs. But the figure may well be closer to $100 million, and this leaves aside, of course, the role played by George Soros, who has a pro-democracy civil society infrastructure around the world. The Russians are convinced, and I don't think they have any reason not to be convinced, because it's happened in country after country, that if Yushchenko is elected with American support, as now seems probable, eventually, maybe not tomorrow, but certainly the day after tomorrow, he will move to take Ukraine into NATO, What that would mean for Russia is that this powerful military alliance would now be sitting right on Russia's western borders, all the way from the Baltics, where NATO already is, to Ukraine, and Russia would have to remove its Black Sea fleet from the ports of Ukraine, a fleet which is absolutely essential to Russia's concept of national security. And into those deep water ports, when the Russians vacate them, would come the NATO fleet. For Russia, this is, rightly or wrongly again, but it's always important to understand the other guy's perspective, this would be a geopolitical catastrophe of almost unparalleled magnitude, short of defeat in war.
Professor Cohen, is the United States consciously taking a gamble to encircle Russia with former allies of the Russian Empire, turning them into allies of the West by taking them into the NATO military alliance? Is that a gamble that you think Washington can win, or is this possibly going to trigger a new Cold War?
The first President Bush, the father of this President Bush, promised Gorbachev that NATO would not move eastward beyond Berlin. That promise was broken by Clinton, and NATO since Clinton has moved ever more eastward, all the way to the Baltics, threatening now Ukraine, talking about entering the Caucasus in the Russia's south. There appears to be no limit to NATO's appetite. Now, when the Kremlin looks out at all this, it sees what you and I see, not only an encirclement of Russia by NATO and American bases, but an intersection of Russia's oil lines to the Caspian Sea. In other words, from the Kremlin point of view, the United States wants Russia's traditional sources of oil. Everybody understands that that is a recipe for eventual conflict. And the policy of taking advantage of Russia while it's weak, of a winner-take-all American military and foreign policy. We won the Cold War. We take it all. Yes, Georgia was yours. Now it's ours. Yes, Ukraine was yours. Now it's ours. Yes, the Caspian was once your oil. Now it's ours. Says to Russia, we will take every advantage of you when you're weak. All this talk of friendship is fraudulent. And moreover, you, Russia, just as you were when you were the Soviet Union and communism, are an illegitimate nation. You have no legitimate rights anywhere in the world. That, to me at least, is an exceedingly unwise, irresponsible American foreign policy, and yet there appears to be no critical thought about it either in the executive branch, in the legislative branch, or even in the mainstream America media. Everybody seems to think it's just fine and the right thing to do.
That was Stephen Cohen, professor of Russian Studies and History at New York University. His latest book is titled Failed Crusade, America and the Tragedy of Post-Communist Russia, published by Norton. December 12th marked the deadliest day for U.S. forces serving in Iraq in more than a month, when 8 U.S. Marines were killed in operations in and around Fallujah. Despite a series of pronouncements designed to assure the American public that the Iraq war is going well, the insurgency continues to grow with security deteriorating across wide swaths of the country. Yet the White House and Iraq's interim government are determined to proceed with national elections scheduled for January 30th, ignoring calls for a delay by a number of important political parties. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, already the target of a lawsuit filed in Germany holding him and other Bush administration officials responsible for torture and war crimes committed in Iraq, recently visited U.S. troops in Kuwait bound for combat duty in Iraq for what he thought was a photo op. But in a meeting with 2,300 soldiers, the defense secretary encountered tough questions from National Guard reservists who asked why they were forced to search out scrap metal to protect their vehicles. Meanwhile, Arizona's Republican Senator John McCain expressed his strong disagreement on the way the war is being run by bluntly telling a reporter that he has no confidence in Rumsfeld. Paul Rykoff, a former U.S. Army first lieutenant who served in Iraq from January 2003 through February 2004, came back to the U.S. with deep concerns about the conduct of the war and the treatment of veterans. He recently founded the veterans advocacy group Operation Truth, where he serves as executive director. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Rykoff about his own experience in Iraq and the reality of the war he is working to convey to the American people.
My father had been drafted during Vietnam, and my grandfather served in the Pacific for a few years during World War II, and I really wanted to give something back. So I enlisted in 1998 and served both on active duty and the National Guard up until 9/11. where my National Guard unit was activated to work downtown at Ground Zero and participate in the rescue effort there. And then from that point on, I knew something was coming and I wanted to be a part of it, so I volunteered to go over. And in January of 2003, I got the call to go down to Fort Stewart to join the 3rd Infantry Division. And we went in with the initial invasion. I was a rifle infantry platoon leader, so I commanded 38 door kickers or grunts. And we ended up in central Baghdad in an area called Adamiya, which is on the eastern bank of the Tigris River, right smack dead in the middle of the city. And we stayed there for about 11 months doing combat operations and did everything from ambushes and mounted patrols, dismounted patrols. We trained the Iraqi police, did some humanitarian missions, and kind of saw the good, the bad, and everything in between. And when I came home, I was kind of shocked to see that the war looked a whole lot different from over here. And I felt like the American people weren't really understanding what was going on the ground over there and were definitely missing the perspective of the soldiers. So I got together with a few guys who served over there and we founded Operation Truth.
Paul Rykoff, what about the war itself in terms of the reasons that the United States went to war in Iraq? We're told it was weapons of mass destruction. We were told it was connections with the September 11th attacks on Washington and New York City. As you went over there and saw firsthand what was going on the ground, did you come away from this war thinking this was a wise decision on the part of the Bush administration in Washington to go forward with this invasion of Iraq?
Well, you know, I was optimistic when I got on the plane, and the rationale was kind of a moving target for me from the outset. You know, they initially said there was a connection to 9/11, then they made a case for overthrowing a ruthless dictator, and they finally put their chips down and said, well, it's weapons of mass destruction. So when I got on the plane to go to Iraq, I remember writing in my journal that George Bush better be right. So when it turned out that he was wrong and there were no weapons of mass destruction, I think we were really stuck in a tough spot there. And I saw the insurgency continue to grow, and I saw, worst of all, is really a failure in planning in Washington. The folks who planned this war really didn't understand what they were biting off here, and I think you saw that with the small number of troops that were extended, the disbanding of the Iraqi army, and the continuing failure to understand the conditions on the ground. Rumsfeld last week got into an exchange with a young soldier named Specialist Wilson, and I think he illustrated perfectly that he really doesn't get it. He doesn't understand what's going on the ground. He doesn't understand that our folks don't have what they need, and I think that's why this conversation really, really needs to be elevated. And I think, you know, the soldiers are all over the place. We're not an anti-war group. We're just a group of soldiers that want to involve ourselves in the conversation and say, you know what, you're not getting the whole truth from the generals and all these other policy wonks. You need to get with the people who've been there, the young soldiers, specialists, privates, who are really in harm's way. They don't have a political agenda, and they can really get down to brass tacks and help the American people understand what's going on and figure out solutions.
I've talked to soldiers and civilians who've been to Iraq, and many of them come away saying, especially in the last 6 months or so, the insurgency is gaining ground, the U.S. Is losing ground, and that a military victory looks more of a remote possibility each and every day. Do you think escalation is the key here to stabilizing and democratizing Iraq? Do you think withdrawal makes sense? Do you think a real sincere assessment of what the real situation there is called for on Capitol Hill? What's your view?
Yeah, I think that's really the critical first step, is an honest assessment about the situation on the ground. And I think what most of the guys come back with is a feeling that it's worse than you think. And Washington and the Pentagon are peddling one story, and the folks on the ground are seeing a very different one. And I saw in fall of last year the insurgency increased dramatically all the way up until the time this spring when I left, and it's continued to escalate since. We've never been able to control the security situation on the ground there, and we've never been able to really have the tools in place to understand the culture, to understand the language, and to understand what the root of this insurgency is. The only solution we've offered is a military one, and there's an old saying that if all you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. I think that's the path that this administration has taken. They haven't seen the economic and political side of this, and I really think it's getting worse every day. For the long-term future, I don't know what's going to happen, but it's not looking good, and we've got to recognize that a change of course is necessary.
The prestigious medical journal, The Lancet, just recently put out some statistics that they estimate as a byproduct of the war in Iraq, the U.S. invasion, that upwards of 100,000 Iraqi civilians have died. What do you think is the effect on the psyche of the Iraqi people in terms of the large numbers, the increasing numbers of civilians that are being killed in the various operations, both from the U.S. and, of course, from the Iraqi insurgency themselves?
Well, I don't think you can downplay it at all, and I think it gets downplayed oftentimes in the American media. You know, even if you say, you know, I don't care about the Iraqi people, you have to understand the effect that this is going to have on the American people. Iraqi people continue to be killed by us and by their own people, and they've really reached a breaking point. So I think it's really going to have a long-term effect on the Iraqi people, and it only adds to the insurgency. I kind of have a theory that I call the Gremlins theory. If you've ever seen the old movie Gremlins, when you pour water on a gremlin, they multiply and it makes more gremlins. Well, that's kind of the situation we've got in Iraq right now. If you kick in a door and kill a member of the family, even if it's accidentally, you're going to create some more insurgents. And that's a tough spot we're in right now in Iraq, and I think the insurgency is growing.
That was Paul Rykoff, a former U.S. Army first lieutenant and founder of Operation Truth. Call the group at area code 212-982-9699 or visit their website at www.optruth.org. In 1996, a group of Americans founded Voices in the Wilderness to respond to the UN-US sanctions imposed on Iraq in 1990. UNICEF, an arm of the United Nations, determined that by the mid-1990s, the sanctions had led to the death of 500,000 Iraqi children. The first Persian Gulf War had destroyed much of Iraq's infrastructure, and the sanctions prevented the country from rebuilding under Saddam Hussein. Voices in the Wilderness opposed first economic sanctions and then the U.S. war against the Iraqi people. The group has organized more than 70 delegations to Iraq in deliberate violation of U.N. economic sanctions and U.S. law. Volunteers have lived alongside ordinary Iraqis before and during the U.S. invasion and throughout the current U.S. occupation of Iraq. In defiance of the sanctions, the group publicly delivered modest amounts of medical supplies to children and families in need, for which the organization has been targeted by the government for a civil penalty of $20,000. Kathy Kelly, a founding member of Voices in the Wilderness, committed civil disobedience last year at the School of the Americas protest at Fort Benning, Georgia. Opponents of the school, which trains Latin American military officers, have long demanded its closure because many of those trained have committed atrocities against their own people. Kelly served 3 months in the Women's Federal Prison in Pekin, Illinois, earlier this year for committing civil disobedience at the Fort Benning protest. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Kelly at this year's SOA Action on November 20th, where the activist spoke about what she learned in prison and why opposing the School of the Americas complements her work against the U.S. military occupation of Iraq.
I had been in Iraq during the Shock and Awe campaign, the so-called Shock and Awe campaign of bombardment and a great deal of destruction and misery inflicted by it. And it seemed to me that U.S. troops had crossed a line, had trespassed into a sovereign country, Iraq, on the theory and the argument that that country had weapons of mass destruction. It turned out that such weapons weren't to be found. But when you cross the line here at the School of the Americas, it's not a theory, it's not an inconclusive argument. It's very, very clear that the graduates of people at the Military Combat Training School are convicted, indicted and convicted of massacres, disappearances, tortures, activities that cause terror to reverberate throughout communities, innocent, often peasant communities. And so I think we need to stand up very, very straight and say, yeah, we don't believe in terrorism. We're going to counter terrorism. We can't really rely on our government with its foreign policy that is creating terrorists faster than you can kill them. We're going to stand up and assert our belief in the works of mercy rather than the works of war. We need to say to people in other countries, yes, we do have compassion. Our hearts do come close to breaking when we hear stories, and then we feel shame when we realize that we're a part of it. When I was in prison in Pekin, Illinois for 3 months, do you know what the women inside working for the federal prison industry were manufacturing? Cages. Small cages to pick up children of deportees caught by the INS at the border. But imagine women who are separated from their own children for 8, 9, 10 years. Imagine then that they are assigned to work making cages to entrap other people's children.
here you were last year at Fort Benning, which basically trains Latin American military people. How did you come to the decision that you were willing to risk, I guess, up to a year in prison when you crossed the line that would take you away from your work with Voices in the Wilderness and your work, you know, your work in Iraq?
People joked a bit when I was getting ready to go to prison. They said, how are we going to answer the phone? Kathy is away from her desk for 3 months. But in a way, I wasn't away from my desk by any stretch of the imagination. By being inside of a prison, I had a chance to focus on terribly important questions that have to do with crossing lines. I didn't expect the focus, and it broke my heart, really, to see it coming out. But the pictures from Abu Ghraib emerged while I was in prison, those iconic images of the hooded man, the man on a leash, and it's all too easy to connect the dots between what happened as a result of training of people in this country to go back to Central and South America and use methods of torture, creating situations of excessive shame and guilt so that the detainee will want to spill information, any information. Well, that was transported, imported, if you will, into the prisons in Iraq when people got very, very frightened. You know, somebody's shooting at our guys, and Rumsfeld wants to know all the information. Get that information however you can. Well, they went to the manuals, and they learned. Try to figure out what causes shame, what causes guilt. And
what manuals are you talking about?
Well, there are torture manuals that exist, and they are in the archives of the School of the Americas, and the School of the Americas Watch has these same manuals. And they're also printed for other groups as well. And a common denominator in these manuals is to teach people, okay, very scientifically, figure out what causes shame and guilt when you want to extract information from people. And what troubles me so much is that there's a temptation to point fingers. Even one of the embeds from the Rolling Stone magazine, who's recently created a book, Evan Wright, his book is called Generation Kill, has said, after he reflected on his experience with a group of Marines, that they were, many of them in the platoon he accompanied, socially maladaptive, heavily armed, and an international liability. Well, I guess I want to say, if that finger is going to point at those Marines, those young 18-year-olds, let it point back at me every time I've acquiesced to a society that thinks that somehow we have a greater right to food and water than other people and their children. We're socially maladaptive. And every time we contribute, I hope nobody does. I haven't paid my taxes since 1979, and I wouldn't dream of it. But every time we contribute to this $524 billion military budget, we're heavily armed, and we're an international liability.
That was Kathy Kelly of Voices in the Wilderness. Contact the group by calling area code 773-784-8065, or visit their website at www.vitw.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Indu Anand, Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.